Good evening. Greetings of peace and blessings. Welcome to the historic Princeton University Chapel. The walls of this chapel are witness to many great interfaith celebrations and conversations, including from the likes of people like Martin Luther King and Muhammad Ali. My name is Imam Soheib Sultan, and I serve as your full-time Muslim chaplain here at Princeton University. Before we begin, one logistical note is that for the Muslims who are looking for an evening space of worship for their Maghrib prayers, right outside the chapel, across on the lawn, you'll find these sheets that are laid out, and so you can immediately after the event offer your prayers. On behalf of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions, the Muslim Life Program in the Office of Religious Life, and the Religious Life Council, who we would especially like to thank for giving up their interfaith hour to make this event possible, I would like to welcome you to this evening's conversation entitled Abrahamic Religion in the Age of Feeling, featuring our very own Dr. Robert George of the Politics Department here at Princeton University, and Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, co-founder and president of Zaytuna College, America's first Muslim liberal arts college based in Berkeley, California. It is my honor to introduce these two public intellectuals and scholars who are shaping our society today. Robert P. George holds Princeton's McCormick Chair in Jurisprudence and is the founding director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. He served as chairman of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and before that on the President's Council on Bioethics, and as a presidential appointee to the United States Commission on Civil Rights. He also served as the U.S. member of UNESCO's World Commission on the Ethics of Scientific Knowledge and Technology. He is a former judicial fellow at the Supreme Court of the United States, where he received the Justice Tom C. Clark Award. He is the author of In Defense of Natural Law, Making Men Moral, Civil Liberties and Public Morality, The Clash of Orthodoxies, Law, Religion and Morality in Crisis, Conscience and Its Enemies, Confronting the Dogmas of Liberal Secularism, and co-author of Embryo, A Defense of Human Life, Body-Self-Dualism in Contemporary Ethics and Politics, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, A Defense of Conjugal Union, What Marriage Is and Why It Matters. His scholarly articles and reviews have appeared in such journals as the Harvard Law Review, the Yale Law Journal, the Columbia Law Review, the American Journal of Jurisprudence, and the Review of Politics. Professor George is a recipient of many honors and awards, including the Presidential Citizens Medal, the Honorific Medal for the Defense of Human Rights of the Republic of Poland, the Canterbury Medal of the Bucket Fund for Religious Liberty, the Sidney Hook Memorial Award of the National Association of Scholars, the Philip Merrill Award of the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, the Bradley Prize for Intellectual and Civic Achievement, and Princeton University's President's Award for Distinguished Teaching. He has given honorific lectures at Harvard, Yale, University of St. Andrews, and Cornell University. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and holds honorary doctorates of law, ethics, science, letters, divinity, humanities, law and moral values, civil law, humane letters, and judicial science. A graduate of Swarthmore College, he holds JD and MTS degrees from Harvard University and the degrees of Doctorate of Philosophy from Oxford University. In November of 2016, he will receive the degrees of BCL and DCL from Oxford. Please give a big round of applause to Dr. Robert George. And in conversation is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf, president and senior faculty member of Zaytuna College, America's first accredited Muslim liberal arts college. He is an advisor to Stanford University's program in Islamic Studies and the Center for Islamic Studies at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. In addition, he serves as vice president for the Forum for Promoting Peace in Muslim Societies, which was founded and is currently presided over by Sheikh Abdullah bin Baya, one of the top jurists and masters of Islamic sciences in the world. Sheikh Hamza is the author of several books and scholarly articles and has translated major creedal Islamic texts into English. Books he has authored or translated include Purification of the Heart, The Content of Character, The Creed of Imam At-Tahawi, Caesarian Moon Births, Prayer of the Oppressed, An Agenda to Change Our Condition. Recently, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf was ranked as the Western world's most influential Islamic scholar by the Muslim 500, edited by John Esposito and Ibrahim Kalin. And on a much more personal and communal note, Sheikh Hamza is a teacher and someone who is responsible for raising a generation of young men and women in this country and putting them on the path to God and love for the Prophet, peace be upon him. So we welcome Sheikh Hamza Yusuf to be in conversation. Thank you all so much for coming, and please enjoy the conversation that is about to begin.
Well, thank you very much, Soheib. On behalf of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and institutions, I want to say how grateful we are to the Program in Muslim Life for co-sponsoring this event with us. It's a pleasure to be working with Imam Soheib and with Arsha and all of our friends in the Muslim community here at Princeton. And a special word of welcome to all our guests, including our many Muslim guests who've come to hear Sheikh Hamza. It's always great to bring Sheikh Hamza to the campus because not only do we get him, but we get so many people, really from the entire corridor, from Washington, D.C. to Boston, who come to hear this eminent scholar and thinker. And it's always a blessing for me personally to be together with my dear friend and collaborator, Sheikh Hamza. Sheikh Hamza and I have worked together on many issues, the sanctity of human life, the question of religious liberty, the attempt to do something about the terrible plague of pornography, which is ravaging our culture, especially our young people, most especially our young men. And working together with him is really an enormous gift to me. I admire Sheikh Hamza not only for his obvious brilliance, but for his courage. It takes a lot of courage to speak the truth out loud, especially in our current climate. Sheikh Hamza has put his very life on the line for the sake of the truth and for the sake of bearing witness to the fundamental values that are shared by the great Abrahamic traditions of faith. So that makes it a special privilege to have the opportunity to be in conversation, public conversation, in your presence with Sheikh Hamza. So I'm going to turn it over to Sheikh Hamza just to give him an opportunity to say hello, and then I'm going to say a word about the title of this evening's conversation and launch us. Hamza?
Okay, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, and prayers and peace upon all of our prophets and our Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. First of all, it's always an honor to come and be with Dr. George. I obviously have great regard for his intelligence and his piety and his commitment to certain things that are very difficult, because he also gets death threats for his positions as well. And I think telling the truth in any time and place has always been a difficult thing. And we are called to be witnesses. I think the Abrahamic traditions share that idea of being witnesses. The Quran says, be witnesses unto the truth. And it actually says, even if it's against your own selves. So sometimes we have to acknowledge the shortcomings within our own traditions, adherence, behavior, and actions. And this is an incredible venue to do this. I think one of the things that both of us share is a love of tradition, and I think one of the hallmarks of true tradition is beauty, and one of the hallmarks of a loss of tradition is ugliness, hence so many ugly modern buildings. So it's really nice to be in such an incredible environment.
Thank you, Hamza. Abrahamic faith in the age of feeling. I suspect I won't have to say much about Abrahamic faith. You know what I'm talking about. The tradition to which Muslims, Jews, and Christians all bear witness and make claim to the revelation to Abraham, who is called by Catholics, I'm myself a Catholic, referred to by Catholics as our father in faith. But other Christians, certainly Jews and Muslims, all say the same thing. We look back to that revelation of God to a human being, to Abraham, on whom certain demands were made and with whom God entered into a covenant. Sociologists, whether they happen to be people of faith or not, refer to Abrahamic faith as a species or perhaps the archetype of what they call ethical monotheism. We understand monotheism, the belief that there is one and only one God. What do the sociologists mean when they say ethical monotheism? This is the idea that the one and only God makes certain demands on human beings who are his creatures, but special creatures, unlike brute animals. Special creatures, animals, yes, but rational animals, who qua rational are free and who can choose and who can therefore choose good or bad, right or wrong, life or death. And the one and only God, according to the traditions of ethical monotheism, enjoins human beings to choose the good over the evil, the right over the wrong, life over death, and to be responsible for our choices. So even if a sociologist is looking at the matter without any reference to personal religious faith, the sociologist recognizes that faith is not simply the human quest for consolation or meaning from a divine source. But with the ethical monotheistic traditions, there is a sense of being under moral obligations, being accountable as rational and free creatures. Now, what about the age of feeling? That's an odd phrase or locution, is it not? What do we mean by the age of feeling? I think the best way to explain it is this way. Intellectual historians and sometimes social historians are very fond of breaking up time into ages or epochs. So those of you who've either formally or informally studied history will know what I'm talking about when I refer to the tendency of intellectual historians to refer to the Middle Ages sometimes as the Age of Faith. The medieval period is sometimes called the Age of Faith. In the Age of Faith, conformity to the truths of religion, whether Muslim, Christian, Jewish, conformity to the truths of faith was the criterion of truth, of goodness, of virtue, the way we distinguished right from wrong, desirable from undesirable, worthy from unworthy. And then the historians tell us there came a period called the Enlightenment. And they refer to the Enlightenment as the age of reason. And in the age of reason, or sometimes called the age of science, it was conformity to the norms of rational inquiry, scientific evidence, empirical or something like empirical fact that was the criterion of truth, of goodness, of rightness, of virtue. Now, of course, those are oversimplifications, and the historians who use those categories would be the first to tell you that there's necessarily oversimplification there. It's not as if no one in the Middle Ages had ever heard of reason, or that they dismissed reason in favor of faith. On the contrary, if we look at the great Jewish thinkers, or the great Muslim thinkers, or the great Christian thinkers of the Middle Ages, and we could all name some of them, we find that they are people who, far from seeing reason and faith in a sharp opposition, see reason and faith rather as forming a unity, as relying on each other and supporting each other, or being mutually supportive. The late Pope, Pope John Paul II, whom we Catholics call Saint John Paul II, Saint John Paul the Great, had a wonderful image for this. He said that faith and reason are like the two wings on which the human spirit ascends to contemplation of the truth. We know that a bird can't get off the ground no matter how hard it flaps. If it's flapping with only one wing, if the other wing is injured, it takes the two wings. And that was certainly true of the great thinkers of the Abrahamic faiths in the medieval period. And yet, who can quarrel really with the characterization of the medieval period as the age of faith? And similarly with the age of reason, with the Enlightenment. It's a caricature of the Enlightenment to suppose that the Enlightenment in all times and all places during the Enlightenment simply threw religion over or threw faith over. Yes, we see that in a writer such as Hume, but not so much in some of the other writers of the period. Read some of the great Scottish Enlightenment figures. Yes, it makes sense to refer to the Enlightenment as the age of reason, but many of the great thinkers of the Enlightenment period saw faith and reason as not necessarily antithetical. But if the medieval period was the age of faith and the Enlightenment was the age of reason, then what is the age in which we live? How would we characterize our age? What do people tend to treat as the criterion of truth as against falsehood, of goodness as against evil, as virtue as against vice, of right as against wrong, as worthiness against unworthiness? Well, here my proposition, which forms the title of our discussion, or figures in the title of our discussion, is there's a profound sense, it's an oversimplification as these things are, but still not entirely false. I think it tells us something about our time if we say that we live in the age of feeling, when the criterion of truth, of goodness, of rightness, is in a certain sense neither faith nor reason. Those hard, objective realities, or so they were thought to be by the great medieval thinkers of the three Abrahamic faiths, or by the thinkers of the Enlightenment, but rather something more subjective, feeling. And so we try to assess the validity of a claim by reference not simply to scientific evidence or to the standards of faith, but to feeling. Is there a reality beyond feeling, or is feeling what is fundamental? Is feeling what is ultimately real? And this, it seems to me, Hamza, is the challenge for the Abrahamic traditions. Perhaps it's also the challenge for the Eastern faiths. I just don't know them well enough to be able to say. It would be very interesting to enter into dialogue with some of our Hindu and Buddhist friends to see how the issue looks to them. But certainly the traditions of the Abrahamic faiths have been formed with the idea that faith and reason are our fundamental criteria of truth. This is not to say that feeling is necessarily bad, or that we learn nothing from the assessment of feeling or the contemplation of feeling or for asking people how they feel, but that feeling is not fundamentally what the reality is. How one feels about something doesn't change the underlying reality of the thing. So ethics, for example, for the great ethical monotheistic religions, is not simply a matter of consulting one's feelings. How do you feel about abortion? How do you feel about the death penalty? How do you feel about whatever the moral issue is? It's what's the underlying reality that can't be changed by how you feel. On the contrary, the task, if we look at the great medieval thinkers, for example, the task is to bring our feelings into harmony with the underlying reality, say the truths of faith, or what can be known by reason. Doesn't work the other way round. And yet, these ancient traditions, living traditions, now confront a new thing. And to what extent empirically do and normatively should our traditions accommodate themselves to the new idea or ideas in the age of feeling, and to what extent is it their duty to resist, to treat the age of feeling or some of its norms as not things to be conformed to, but rather as ideas to be resisted, lest the truths of the faith be lost. And here, I think, is where the rubber meets the road, and then I'll hand it over to Sheikh Hamza. All of these great ethical monotheistic traditions, in their traditional formulations, make powerful demands on the faithful. They require not just the specialists in religion, the priests, the rabbis, the imams, but all men and women. They make demands to high standards of ethical conduct. The virtues, all of them, honesty to chastity, courage, fidelity, are demanded of all. And they're hard demands in many cases to live up to. It's not just the easy stuff. At least as traditionally understood, to be a Muslim, to be a Jew, to be a Christian, is not an easy thing. Not only are there ritual demands, in the case of Islam and Judaism, also dietary restrictions and those sorts of things, there are the high moral demands of ethical monotheism. No matter how you feel about them, no matter how much you might desire another man's wife, you can't have her precisely because she is another man's wife. No matter how much you covet or think you could use better, make better use of another person's property, you can't take it. No matter how you feel about it. Difficult, demanding norms that can't be relativized or set aside on the basis of how anyone feels. I'll close this opening remark by just telling a story of a famous fellow Christian, not a woman I've ever met, But a famous Christian evangelist, in this case an evangelical Christian, singer, known far and wide throughout the evangelical Christian community. She left her husband for another woman's husband. And when she did, her public justification for an act condemned by her faith was that God would not have put into her heart her love for this new man, or into his heart his love for her, if he did not mean them to be together, even though it meant abandoning their own families. There, it seems to me, is the challenge for the Abrahamic faiths in the age of feeling. Mm. The criterion of that singer for the rightness of an action is not faith as such. We know what the Christian faith or Jewish faith or Islamic faith says about adultery. It's not even the demands of reason. That wasn't her plea. It was that she knew something about where she belonged and what it was right for her to do, or at least not wrong for her to do, in virtue of something subjective, not objective. Something personal to her. Her feelings. Hamza?
Well, you know that Plato considered the poets great corruptors of societies, and she was probably a woman that grew up on songs from the 60s that had lyrics like, "If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right."
Oh, I remember that one.
Or, "If you can't be with the one you love,
love the one you're with." Yeah.
So
those are perfect songs. Those are the hymns of the age of feeling.
Right. So, yeah, feelings are important. Feelings are very interesting. Feelings in some ways are what make us human. But we don't simply feel, because animals, we know, feel. Animals have feelings. We actually have dogs in our culture that are on Prozac because they're depressed. Veterinarians actually do use antidepressants on dogs. One of the things that this dog whisperer says is that he's found that it's always the family that's depressed that makes the dog depressed. It's never the dog. He's just reflecting the feelings that he's getting.
The vibes, huh?
Good vibrations, yeah, or bad vibrations, to quote another 60s song. So one of the problems, I think, with religion today is that it has lost in many ways its true defenders, because historically the vast majority of people, and today the vast majority of believers, are people that that feel in their hearts that what they believe is right and true, and a lot of it is non-cognitive. It's not really, faith is not so much about reason for a lot of believers, but that faith traditionally, and as you well know, was considered a very flimsy faith and a dangerous faith to have, because somebody could create doubt in their hearts, and this is certainly what the role that the devil plays, whether it's a human incarnation of that concept or whether it's doubts that come to the mind, however you want to call the devil, he's got a lot of names. But the Muslims actually felt that faith had to be rooted in reason, and this was the dominant opinion. It was to such a degree that some scholars actually argued that blind conformity to faith was unacceptable. But the majority said, if that was the case, then we would have to say the vast majority of believers did not have faith. And so they compromised, and this is from Tajuddin al-Subki, an 8th century scholar from Syria, who said, as long as the faith could withstand the loss of faith of the one that they were blindly following, then it was true faith. It's an interesting concept. So I think the age, and you know, Durant's famous history of civilization. He's got the age of faith and then the age of reason, which I think is a really problematic type of taxonomy, because I think in some ways the age of faith is far more reasonable than the modern period, because they rooted so much in reason and they thought deeply about what reason was. And just to give you an example, the ethical crises, I mean, you're very well aware of the fact that Hume created a major problem when he made a distinction between prescriptive and descriptive statements. So he said you could not get an ought from an is statement. So if you had a factual statement, you could not get some kind of prescriptive ought from that statement. So you can't say that cigarette smoking causes cancer, therefore you ought not smoke. But that's not something that can be proven demonstrably by any stretch. This was the idea, and obviously Kant, this was a crisis for him to try to root virtue ethics in some other let me see if I can pull this down, to root ethics in some other foundation than it was previously rooted in. And so he attempted to root it in human reason. But we know that all of the Abrahamic faiths were committed to the idea of philosophical ethics, that there was actually a way of reasoning in which you could arrive at a prescriptive truth from a descriptive reality. And one of the things that I teach in our ethics course, I teach the Nicomachean Ethics, and in book 6 he makes a very interesting distinction about
this would be Aristotle
yeah. about descriptive and prescriptive truths. He said they're different. They're different types of truths, and he argues that prescriptive truth is rooted in right desire. And this is something in many ways that the modern world rejects, this idea of right desire. And Aristotle would argue, and I think all of the great ethicists from the Jewish, the Islamic, and the Christian tradition would agree with that argument, that right desire is the desire that leads to happiness and fulfillment of the human being. And if the desire is perverted, then it will actually lead to the opposite, which is the soul becomes troubled. And I think it's very hard to argue, given the type of society that we are living in now, it's very hard to argue that people are happy when we actually look at the statistics and social sciences that we have out there. I don't think people are doing very well. On the other hand, it's arguable that every time and place has these crises also. But as somebody who, I lived in a Bedouin culture, and what really struck me in living with Bedouin is I didn't see anybody that had any signs of depression. Like the people that I lived with in West Africa were deeply rooted in faith and reason. This was one of the rare examples in human history of an Aboriginal nomadic people that had a scholastic tradition. So I actually studied inside a tent Aristotelian logic with a Bedouin teacher, which is really amazing. And I'll just give you an example that in the Islamic tradition, there's a 4th century scholar, Abu Bakr al-Baqalani, who came up with a unique atomic theory of the world. And Putnam, in his book on the history of atomic theories, actually argues in the chapter on Islamic atomic theory that this is a unique theory, that it doesn't come out of Greek thought. And a lot of it's based on Euclidean geometry and the concept of a point, but I remember once this student was trying to understand what he meant that the world was made up of atoms. And my teacher, he took a handful of sand and he blew it. And he said, if the veil was lifted, you would see everything look like this. And so here's a very primitive people, on the one hand, a very primitive society. But on the other hand, they were grappling with some really, really sophisticated ideas. And it made me wonder, what was it like in the great centers of civilization, like Baghdad and Fez and Tunis and Damascus? If this is the Bedouin remnant of that tradition, because Mauritania is one of the last places that really has this scholastic tradition, that they're holding on to it. And so I think the importance and centrality of rooting things in reason for the Abrahamic peoples was so central to the tradition. What's happened now is because of a loss of real metaphysics and as you know, the most fundamental metaphysical question is, why is there something as opposed to nothing? And this, most people don't really, that idea does not occupy their thoughts, but if they would allow it to occupy their thoughts will automatically make an exponential leap from where they are in their unexamined existence to really having a difficult question put in front of them. And I think modern people don't realize how profound that question is. And then the other thing I would add to that is, because science, as you know, the science today is the only acceptable methodology to examine reality. So empirical science is the only way that we can really examine reality, that philosophy in its medieval sense of the word, or even ancient sense of the word, is seen now as really meaningless statements, that it's purely speculative thought, and that's because the idea, if we're in this church and this is all we know of the world, we don't know about Princeton, let alone New Jersey, let alone the United States, let alone the planet Earth, let alone the universe. We're just in this church and we've been here all our lives and this is all we've ever known. And if somebody escapes and comes into the church and tells us there's a whole other world out there, most of the people in the church would find that very difficult to believe if this is all they've ever known. And one of the problems with modern thought is they deny the possibility of ever getting outside of material reality. And yet thought itself is an immaterial reality. And therefore thinking about it is already being outside of it. Mm-hmm. Because consciousness, no matter how hard they try, they have never proven that consciousness has a material basis.
This is, I think, the important aspect of the philosopher Thomas Nagel, the contemporary atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel's critique of contemporary scientism, whether it's Darwinian or otherwise, that we cannot come up with a material, purely material, scientistic explanation of consciousness itself. It does seem to be an immaterial reality. Archie, we're having trouble, aren't we?
We could just have your lapel on the other side. People can barely hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's probably...
You're missing the good part.
Lift it up just a little bit higher.
How's that? Is that better?
A little bit, yes.
All right. I apologize. All right. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Sheikh Hamza just said a whole bunch of good stuff. I'm sorry you missed... I'm sorry you missed it. Let me... try a thought that what you said just provoked in me, and maybe it'll give you a sense of what he just said. What you described, the idea that the only way of getting to the truth of something, actually understanding something, was the use of the scientific method. This is what Hayek called scientism.
Right.
Yeah. Philosophically defended by the logical positivists in the early
right.
part of the 20th century, the Vienna School, and so
right.
forth. That strikes me as a form of fundamentalism.
Right.
It's not
false all the way down, because you can learn a lot of important stuff through science. Where
Absolutely.
Would we be without science? And there's some things that cannot be studied except
by science.
The scientific method. But of course, the problem is what it leaves out, what we can know by other intellectual activities, other ways of inquiring, including things like meaning itself. On the other hand, while I agree with you that there's a strong prejudice in our culture in favor of scientism, especially in some sectors of the intellectual class, in the sciences themselves, although there are plenty of scientists who reject scientism,
right.
but still sometimes
yeah.
there, and in the social sciences,
right.
where an effort is made to try to explain social reality, which
right.
are, after all, reality phenomena that are constituted, at least in part, by human deliberation, judgment, choice, and action, trying to explain social reality by purely scientific methods, which you know has to be a failure if you understand that people have, in addition to all sorts of other things, freedom of the will.
Right.
Right? So it can't be, you can't just account for human activity comprehensively the way you can account for the movement of billiard balls across a plane, across a billiard table or something
right.
like that. Well, I agree with all that. It seems to me that at the same time, there's a kind of fundamentalism at the other extreme, which takes the form of, ideologically, takes the form of postmodernism.
Right.
And that's the idea that nothing can be trusted
right.
intellectually.
Yeah.
That intellectual work, whether it is in literature, whether it is in history, whether
right.
it's in the sciences
right.
themselves in the extreme case, is simply rationalizations for power.
Right.
And what the goal of intellectual activity should be is essentially manipulative.
Right.
You know, shifting power, gaining power for the powerless, if that's our thing, getting power for oneself, if that's one's thing. And it seems to me that too is a form of fundamentalism. You know, if you're going to understand literature and history and a lot of other things, among the things you have to understand are power relations.
Right.
But that's not the whole picture. That's only
right.
a part of the picture, perhaps
right.
a relatively small
well,
part of the picture.
I think those ideas, if you look at the fundamental influencers behind those ideas, they were all alienated individuals, and not as an ad hominem attack against them, but if you look at Derrida, Derrida was a Jew raised in Algeria in a very alienated environment. Michel Foucault was a homosexual in a society that did not accept that behavior as normative behavior. And Edward Said, who really starts post-colonial studies, is a Palestinian disenfranchised in his own land. So I think that the appeal of a lot of the post-structuralist critical theorists is very strong, because it's they're voicing those who people consider having no voices. But when you look at the intellectual history of where these ideas come from, they also become, I think, completely disempowering ideas. I find them completely disempowering ideas. And they end up also not allowing for any metaphysical understanding of what the world means to me as an individual. Like, what is happening here? And when you remove God from the equation, then I think critical theory makes perfect sense. But when God is still part of the way you're understanding the world, critical theory, I think, especially in its post-structuralist iteration, is the single most dangerous thing to theology and to Abrahamic metaphysics.
So if you disenchant the world, you would expect both of those things, scientism and postmodernism or post-structuralism?
I think so, because science has largely, if we look in our country, about 80%, I don't know the exact figures, but a large number of our scientists are actively engaged in the military-industrial complex. And
So science, in some ways, scientists have prostituted themselves to the temptations of serving power, to put this in a critical theory way of looking at the world. And I think, for instance, I don't think anybody with true faith could ever invent the napalm bomb. I just don't believe that. I think if they had an ounce of ethical character, they just could not come up with a bomb that burnt people. And one of the most terrifying things to me is that when the Viet Cong began to build large ponds in the middle of their villages, so when the napalm came, they would run and jump in the water. A scientist here developed waterproof napalm as a way of preventing that from happening. And so I think a lot of what has happened in our lifetime, the 20th century has been one of the, it actually has been the bloodiest century in human history. Wars fought on ideological grounds, but having very little to do with religion, unless you define religion as ideology.
Which is what Christopher Hitchens tries to do.
Exactly. I think they all try to do that, and I don't think it's really fair to religion. I mean, human beings have obviously ways of understanding the world, and these modern ideas, certainly materialism and Marxism, have been very appealing to large numbers of people, and mostly to people that have been oppressed. One of the things I find really fascinating in Marxism is the quote that religion is the opiate of the masses. Like, this is Marx's great mm-hmm. statement of religion, but it's never quoted in its entirety, because what he said was religion is the sigh of the oppressed. It's the heart of a heartless world. It's the soul of a soulless place. It is the opiate of the masses. In other words, it's a way of numbing the pain of the world. Now, what our modern world has done, it has removed religion to fulfill the function of a actually healthy opiate, and it's replaced it with a real opium. We have a huge opioid crisis right now in this country. People are numbing themselves to the pain of the world because they have lost spiritual grounding in what the world is and what it has always been. I think one of the myths of the modern world somehow is that I think the whole idea of progress and this idea that human beings can transcend their nature, and now we've got transhumanism, which is really, they're giving us a utopian, a technological utopia. They're going to remove all of these problems with being human through this transhumanistic adventure. And they're spending billions of dollars. This is not a joke. They're spending billions of dollars on this. And this is something C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man was one of his great concerns. And I'm amazed at his prescience to really call attention to these things. Another person is Lewis Mumford, who's, I don't think, read anymore. But Mumford, to me, if you read Mumford's trilogy on the Pentagon of Power, Mumford saw what was happening as well. And so I think a lot of our intellectuals in the 20th century were very troubled by what they saw coming. But what's confronting us right now as a species, without the ethical tools that allow for really serious prescriptive answers, we can possibly completely lose our humanity.
Are we addicted culturally to consolation and comfort? In other words, is that why people are turning to opioids, or treating religion as mere consolation? It sounds as though, you know, when
my father used to say that Hollywood could never do tragedy.
Yeah,
it's just not capable of doing tragedy. They always had to make a
happy ending,
yeah. You know, because tragedy is the two halves of life on earth: the comedic and the tragic. And so, I think people do want to, in the end, the world, you know, I tell people, that I talked to about this. I actually did a lecture called The 17 Benefits of Tribulation, which has really helped a lot of people. I actually heard somebody tell an incredible story the other day about it. But one thing I tell them is that the world is designed to let you down, that it is fundamentally designed to let you down, because you cannot put your faith in the world. If you put your faith in the world, you will always be let down. And I think that this diabolic impulse, this idea somehow that the man can solve all of his problems, and this is certainly where technologists reside. They reside in this world that we're going to have a pharmaceutical solution to these problems. And these problems can never be solved technologically. They can't be solved pharmaceutically. And I don't believe they're going to be solved through transhumanism. I think transhumanism is just another arrogant attempt at playing God.
Well, I'm sure you're right about that. To go back, though, to this question of religion and consolation, I don't think anyone can deny that among the things we look for in our faith and among the attractions of faith, certainly the Abrahamic traditions, again, I don't know as much about the Eastern traditions, one of the things we look for is consolation.
Right.
And some of the great saints in the different traditions have...
The Holy Spirit, the gift of consolation is
consolation,
one of the seven
exactly
gifts
right,
of the Holy
of the
Spirit.
Holy Spirit, right, in Christianity. And yet, Marx's account, and you were right to quote the whole thing to get it in context, and it's far less dismissive of religion, you're right, when you hear it in context. Still, he's focusing all the way back in, the 1840s?
Right.
On the consolation side of religion. But religion makes tremendous demands. So where does that fit into the picture? The tribulations maybe are not so bad,
right?
Because you get something out of them.
Suffering is redemptive.
And if you put your faith in the world, you're going to be disappointed.
Right.
But it's not... I agree that suffering is redemptive. King preached that. Martin Luther King preached that notion. But it's not the suffering itself that it seems to me God is looking for in making the demands on us. The demands, the basis of the demands is not the suffering will do you good, the challenge will do you good.
Right.
Because then the challenge could be anything. It's that in fulfilling these demands, you grow, you are enriched,
right.
Your humanity is fulfilled. You rightly cited Aristotle earlier and his teaching that that the ethical life is the way of, to use the Greek, eudaimonia. Now, you read modern translations of Aristotle, and eudaimonia is almost always translated
happiness.
As happiness. There was a time when that was not misleading, because there was a time not all that long ago when happiness was a morally inflected concept. It didn't just mean a desirable psychological state where you go around with a smile on your face that might be induced by Valium or being placed on Bob Nozick's experience machine or something.
Right.
We still can perceive a little of that sense of the morally inflected notion of happiness. If we hear a statement, it sounds archaic, but we still understand it. We hear a statement like, happy the man who walks in the way of justice.
Right.
We know that doesn't mean that the man who walks in the way of justice is going to have a smile on his face all the time and be in a kind of Valium type state, because we know the man who walks in the way of justice is probably going to suffer.
Right.
He's probably going to suffer. And yet, that's the happiness that Aristotle has in mind. So I think it's better to translate today.
Right.
Language shifts, we understand that.
Yeah.
Today, to use the second term you used, which is fulfillment or...
flourishing.
Or flourishing. And it seems to me that in ethical monotheism, certainly in the Jewish and Christian and Islamic traditions, God imposes these demands because these are the way of human well-being.
Right.
The suffering may have benefits. It certainly has costs. But... this is the way of eudaimonia. This is the way of flourishing. And, of course, the tradition of philosophy that I myself represent and work in, the so-called natural law tradition, is a tradition that attempts to understand by way of rational
sure.
deliberation, inquiry,
right.
understanding, judgment,
right.
tries to understand the basis, the rational basis in the well-being of the human being, of the moral norms. Hume, as you pointed out, at least thought that he introduced the distinction between
descriptive
what is and what ought to be, the descriptive and the prescriptive. But then, as you pointed out, if we go all the way back to Aristotle, centuries upon centuries before Hume, and it's developed then by the greatest Thomist of
sure.
all time, or the greatest Aristotelian of all time, Thomas Aquinas, he develops it. And this is the idea of the distinction between practical and theoretical reasoning.
Right.
So practical reasoning is our reasoning of the sort that enables us to grasp the intelligible point of something as providing a more than merely instrumental reason for our action, which could only present a reason to us if it is capable of being understood as an aspect of human well-being and fulfillment, our own, others, our community, but some aspect of human well-being and fulfillment. So take the example that you used of cigarette smoking. The fact that cigarettes cause cancer is by itself, just isolated, just a fact.
Right.
How do you get from there to you ought not to smoke cigarettes?
Right.
Well, Aristotle or St. Thomas Aquinas would say there's an additional
right.
premise that's provided by our
truth.
Deliberation, our judgments of practical reason, and that is that among the aspects of our well-being and fulfillment that we grasp as providing intelligible reasons
right.
is our physical well-being. It's not the only one.
Right.
There's our intellectual well-being.
Yeah.
There's our well-being as social
right.
creatures, our the quality of our relationships, our friendships, our familial bonds, and so forth. There's the intellectual, there's the social, there's the physical. There are many, many dimensions of our all-round well-being and fulfillment. And what the norms God demands of us, these demanding requirements that are imposed by the ethical monotheistic faiths, are not God punishing us or even testing us.
Or limiting our pleasures.
That's right. Right. But showing us the way
to fulfillment. I think in the Islamic tradition, and I was going to bring this about the book that you wrote, Conscience and Its Enemies. In that first chapter, you talked about those necessary conditions. And you mentioned, for instance, just human dignity, the idea of human dignity, preservation of family, the protection of family, and then law, that you needed to have a government to protect life and property. And I wanted, I told you this before, I wanted to write an article called When Robert George Meets Fakhruddin al-Razi, or Imam al-Juwayni. Because Imam al-Juwayni, who was the teacher of al-Ghazali, and if al-Ghazali is to Islam what Aquinas is to Christianity.
I think we have a window for him, do we not?
Al-Razi is
here.
But al-Ghazali was a student of Imam al-Juwayni. Imam al-Juwayni said that there are six things that religion came to preserve, and you identified most of them in that article. He said the first one was life itself, the preservation of life, because we cannot know that life is sanctified except through a supernatural means to do that.
Sanctification.
That it's sanctified. We can obviously through reason. We can make arguments that thou shalt not, murder, unjustified killing. But the argument that it's that the soul is sanctified is something that comes from a supernatural source. And so he argues that preservation of life, preservation of property is another one. The idea that human beings, they need a certain modicum of goods to live, and those goods that are in their possession should be protected from other people aggressing on them. And preservation of religion itself, which you missed, the preservation of religion. And then preservation of intellect. So for instance...
that was my number four.
Right, exactly, number four. You got five out of the...
Yeah, it's not bad, right?
I was definitely impressed.
I mean, think of a baseball player.
Right. And then he said preservation of family. And the last one, the sixth one, was preservation of human dignity.
I got that.
Yeah. And so those six things, according to Islamic law, all of the laws in Islam go back to preserving one of those six things. So the prohibition of alcohol is to preserve the intellect. The prohibition of murder to preserve life. The prohibition of theft to preserve property. The prohibition of fornication and adultery to preserve family. And the prohibition of torture is to preserve human dignity. There's no law in Islam that you cannot take
back. And
would
religion be blasphemy?
The blasphemy law is preservation of religion. Yeah. And so what's fascinating to me is that Fakhruddin al-Razi, who comes after, says we can reduce all of these to two principles. That religion is here to accrue benefits for human beings and to ward off harm. And this, as you well know, was the fundamental reason why within ourselves are these two forces, the concupiscent or the desirous force, the appetitive soul, and the irascible soul, this soul that gets angry, real indignation. So the appetitive soul, the appetites that we have are to benefit our bodies. And the irascible is to ward off harm. But when these two override the regulator of those two,
rationality,
which is reason, mm-hmm. right? When Imam al-Ghazali talks about the pig soul, the dog soul, and the sage soul, and so the pig soul needs to have the shepherd, right? Making sure that it doesn't overeat itself or eat its own young, because pigs will eat their own mm-hmm. young if they're hungry enough. And then the dog soul ends up can attack this poor woman who lost her face. Yeah. She recently died. She had tried to commit suicide, and the dog was trying to wake her up and bit off her face, trying to wake her up, but it was her own dog. So it wasn't trying to harm her, but in the end it did harm her trying to save her. So the dog soul, when it takes over, will end up harming even though it's there to benefit. Yeah. And so Al-Ghazali adds a fourth component, which Aristotle didn't see, and I think it's very interesting, and I've thought a lot about this, and he might be wrong, but Aristotle thought that if these three were in balance, which are the three virtues, right, because the virtue of the sage, the virtue of reason was wisdom or prudence, the virtue of the irascible soul was courage, and the virtue of the appetitive soul was temperance. He said if these three were functioning in accordance to right desire and working, then it resulted in the fourth cardinal virtue, which was justice. Ghazali argued, actually, that justice was the faculty of balance. And one of the interesting things, you use the word deliberation, that we deliberate, which is from delibere, which is out of balance. Like, we weigh things. This is what the reasonable human being will do when they're confronted with problems, is to weigh things. Mm. And to deliberate. And in many ways, we're living in a world where we have lost balance. We're profoundly out of balance. We're out of balance. And I mean, one of the things, this is a great example of complete insanity. You know, the plastic bottle. And I will give you an example. I brought a Bedouin here from West Africa. He's a brilliant man, really well versed in a lot of sciences. And we were in Arizona, in New Mexico, And I was teaching a course there, and he was with me. And this person took one of these cups and drank something and threw it in the garbage can. And he asked me, what is that? And I said, what, the garbage can? He said, why did he throw that cup in there? And I said, well, those cups are made for one-time use. And he said, that is a very bad sign when a civilization reaches that level of extravagance. Like, he was horrified by that, because he
sin of luxury.
Luxuria. Mm. He grew up in a place where everything is recycled, because desert people live with very limited resources. And so the idea of creating a bottle to be used once and thrown out is complete insanity. And this is not sustainable. Nobody can argue for the sustainability of a lifestyle of going to Starbucks every day and getting that cup and just throwing it into the garbage can, and recycling is a total lie. I mean, yeah. So these are real problems of balance.
It's hard to know, you know, how far to press this and how much things are related to each other. But Pope Francis has made one of the themes of his pontificate the idea that we need to turn away from this path we've gone down, what he calls the disposable society.
Right.
So on the one hand, he does this critique of disrespect for the environment, treating everything as disposable, as exploitable, as usable. But he sees that, rightly or wrongly, as connected with a larger attitude of disposability, that we dispose of relationships. If they're no longer giving us our kicks, or we're no longer getting what we want out of them, whether it's a personal friendship, cast a friend aside, whether it's a marriage, we cast a wife or a husband aside, whether it's a relationship with an institution, whatever happened to institutions?
Right.
You know, there's no loyalty, fidelity to the institutions.
Yeah. Right.
And that, you know, there's probably something to... Now, you know, on the one hand, you can't say, well, look, because people are willing to throw away, make one use of plastic cups and throw them away, that means they're going to throw away spouses.
It's related.
Well, that's the question.
I think it is related. And about loyalty, you know, Jackie Robinson, he refused to be traded at the end of his career. He because he was a Brooklyn Dodger. So it's odd to think about that, but there was a time when people actually had real commitments to, they worked in corporations for careers, and the idea of moving to, like, headhunting now, this idea that you can, because when you have a society where avaricia, you know, I was just at UC Berkeley, and I gave this talk to a group of students at UC Berkeley, and I asked them if they knew what the seven deadly sins were.
Good luck.
Yeah, first of all, they asked, what are sins? But no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, and sin is a beautiful word, because sin, the word in Arabic for sin is khati'a, which has the exact same meaning as sin in Greek, in Hebrew, and in English, Old English. It's an archery term.
Really?
Yes,
nice.
For missing the
missing
mark.
The ball.
And one of the things they asked Jordan, the basketball player, what do you think about when you miss a shot? And he said, too far, too short, too much to the left, too much to the right. You know, in other words, you need to and so archery, it's taught in so many traditional cultures because it teaches you that the flaw is always it's not the target, it's you.
It's your aim, yeah.
And so sin is missing the target. It's mistaking an apparent good for a real good. And this is something that we don't understand. But what I said to them was that the sin of greed is not to be greedy one time. The sin of lust is not to look on another person lustfully one time or two times or even 10 times. It's actually a state of being. To be in that state where it has taken over your soul. And in that way, it's a mortal sin because it's putting you in a state that is so dangerous for your own fulfillment. It will destroy the possibility to be fulfilled in this life and possibly in the next life. And so the idea of how do we then rectify this? And this is where religion and the ethical aspect of religion, one of my favorite quotes from Confucius is, he said, when I was 15, I set my heart on learning. When I was 30, I had no more doubts. When I was 40, I knew the mandate of heaven. When I was 50, I knew the mandate of heaven. When I was 60, my ear was obedient. And when I was 70, I could fulfill my heart's desire without going astray. That idea of working on the self, which you talk a lot about in your book, about self-mastery, that idea has been so removed from the spiritual being of the human being. And where we see it is in sports. We see it in sports. Incredible discipline in sports. I mean, our great athletes have phenomenal discipline.
And then they go tear up bathrooms.
Exactly. Yeah. And musicians also. And you're a great musician, and you know how much work it takes to actually achieve that type of mastery. But the idea of mastering the soul has really been removed from our civilization. And that to me is the greatest tragedy.
Well, let me tie that back as best I can to the theme of this conversation. What Sheikh Hamza is referring to in my own thought is a position that I've been pushing very hard, that while there are many different types of freedom, many different important and valuable types of freedom, including our basic civil liberties and so forth, that the most important type of freedom is not freedom from anybody else's oppression,
right,
but rather self-mastery, freedom from being a slave to one's own wayward desires or passions or feelings or emotions, where one is in control of oneself. And of course, my tutor on this, since I haven't ever actually thought of anything new, I get this from Plato, Aristotle's great teacher. And Plato taught that the goal in life for each of us is to get our souls properly ordered. He wasn't afraid to use the term soul. He's not from an ethical monotheistic tradition, although very interestingly, in Plato's dialogues, you'll be reading along and it seems that he is haphazardly using the plural gods and God in
right.
the singular.
Jowett's translation, he very often uses God.
Sometimes it's God, sometimes it's the gods.
Right.
And my own study of this has persuaded me that the distinction basically comes down to this, that when he's invoking divinity
right.
more or less ritualistically, he goes along with the flow of the time and refers to the gods, the honored Greek polytheism. But when the concept of divinity is doing any real analytical work right. in the argument, he tends to go to the singular. Still,
well, I would argue that because we know that arc is an Indian arc.
Yeah.
So we know that a lot of the origins of
are
from India. And in India, there is a very strong argument that Hinduism is a monotheistic tradition and that the Hindus distinguish between what they call nirguna and sirguna. These are two qualities of the divinity, and the sirguna is the various ways that God reveals himself, and these become personified in deities, but they're actually only personification. The Brahmins know this, but the common people tend not to know it. And the nirguna is what in Christianity they would call the Godhead, that it is the transcendent, unidentifiable, the Tao that is named is not the eternal
right.
Tao. And so I think it's the way I read it, and this might be just my own desire to see Plato
well,
as a monotheist, but that's how I read it.
Influences.
And I know that the seventh letter, Plato is very clear that he never articulated his true doctrine. So the idea that Aristotle and Plato and Socrates were not in a religious tradition, I think, is completely false.
But my point...
And many of the early Muslim scholars considered the possibility of Socrates being a prophet and Plato...
Oh, how interesting.
Yes, and Plato and Aristotle, students of a prophet.
That's interesting. Some of the early Christian fathers speculated about whether Plato might have had either A, some access to the Hebrew scripture, or B, had been given a special personal revelation of the content of the Hebrew scripture, because they couldn't otherwise account for his wisdom.
Right.
Yeah. But where I was going with the point about self-mastery that Sheikh Hamza introduced is Plato's teaching that our goal, our mission, is to properly order the soul. And the soul does have parts. There's the appetitive, the
right.
spirited, and the rational. And when we're disordered, the rational is no longer in control.
Right.
Appetite,
right.
typically.
Feeling
is
also,
in control.
Yeah.
That's feeling,
yeah.
right? And so what happens to reason? What happens to rationality in that context? Well, we all have the experience in this fallen world. We all know what happens. It's not just that reason disappears. On the contrary, reason now gets harnessed by desire, by appetite,
right.
by emotion,
right.
in the cause of cooking up rationalizations
right.
for conduct that is, in truth, morally wrong.
Right.
And so what happens? Sin. What happens is we damage our own character. We damage our own, whatever else, whatever harm we do externally,
right.
the fundamental harm to ourself is unavoidable by the disordering of the soul. And then it's got to be put back into shape, and that's very
right.
difficult to do. It requires discipline. It requires mastery. Where the soul is ordered properly, of course, reason is in charge. It's not a Stoic or Buddhist doctrine in which the goal is to eliminate desire or eliminate feeling or eliminate motion. No, that's not it. And the traditions into which Plato's thought, that Plato's thought contributed to, are not traditions that say get rid of desire, get rid of emotion. No,
right.
they're traditions that say make sure reason's in charge.
It's balance.
It's balance. That's exactly right. It's back to that concept
yeah.
of in a way of justice.
Yeah.
It's getting things in right order where reason has the controlling
right.
hand over desire. Now, you want desire because you want to get things done.
Right.
But you want to get good things done, and this is what enables us to distinguish right desire or good desire
right.
from bad desire, since desire is not just a given.
Right.
You know,
and good desire fulfills the human being in a true sense of that meaning, that it contributes to his eudaimonia,
yeah.
Whereas wrong desire, I mean, one of the things that our scholars say is that disobedience out of pleasure is always followed by inqibat, by a constriction
yeah.
of the soul, and that obedience that often involves constriction of the soul because it's hard to do is always followed by an expansiveness, and it's one of the signs that you've done something good is that it's followed by that what in the Quran calls inshirah, you know, that there's it feels good, and this is why people don't like to exercise, but after they finish exercising, they always feel good. So when we do things that are good for ourselves that we don't like, they're always what follows is something very, very positive. Whereas when you eat that cheesecake that initially appears very desirable, but afterwards you're like, why did I do that? Exactly.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, these are very mundane examples, but when it gets to sin, like really serious, because the cheesecake isn't going to put your soul into perdition, but that other person's wife will. And those will never lead. And we have innumerable films where the scene after the sin is,
yeah.
why did I do that?
And it's
that?
Just our common experience.
Right.
I mean, it's our human experience. Back to religion. We mentioned earlier Hitchens' efforts to blame all evil
on
religion by identifying the great right. ideologies that produced the bloodbaths of the 20th century on religion. At the same time, I think in trying to rectify that slander against religion, we have to acknowledge, as men of faith, that much wrong has been done and is being done in the name of
religion.
And much of your witness, of course, right now, and
right.
you've so courageously, you know, borne the consequences with the threats against yourself, is an effort within the Islamic world to stand up against crimes that are being committed in the name of religion. And I don't doubt, at least in some cases, sincerely, not just where religion is being used as a cover for something else. But, you know, we look at the history of Christianity, we see the same thing.
Sure.
Now, you know, it's been, the numbers are not anywhere on the scale of what fascism or Nazism or communism produced just in terms of the death toll. But
or capitalism.
Or liberal secularism. I mean, if we look
yeah.
at the abortion holocaust,
yeah.
right?
I mean, so, there's a million dead Iraqis.
Yeah, true enough.
Yeah.
So we have to, I think, you know, face up to that reality as well, but not, I think, by rejecting anything about religion itself,
right.
but rather by drawing on the resources, and here, of course, you've done it brilliantly as well as courageously, the resources within our own traditions for the critique
right.
of the forces within our traditions that have resorted unjustifiably
right.
to violence. I don't see any alternative to that. It seems to me wherever evil is being done
right.
in the name of faith, people from that faith have got to draw on the resources of that faith
right.
for the critique of the wrongdoing. Otherwise, it's just going to be constant war.
Well, I think one of the great crises and calamities of the current situation is that the faiths are enlisted in political conflicts. Like right now, the Iranian Arab crises. I mean, it's not about Sunni Shia conflicts. This is about Persian Arab politics, and yet religion is always enlisted.
It's a kind of overlay.
I consider it's impressed.
Yeah.
You know, it's forced into. It's not enlisted. It's impressed. And so that's a real problem. But I think that if we look at the major crisis in Islam right now, it's a crisis of authority. And the Catholics have an advantage because they have the magisterium, and so the Pope and the See of Cardinals, they can determine what policy, if for want of a better word,
right.
what doctrine is.
You're not
is.
Relying on charismatic authority.
Exactly. And that helps to a great deal. The Muslims are like the rabbinical tradition. We have a scholastic tradition which traditionally was based on what was called isnad, or chains of transmission. So one of the things they always ask Jesus, you know, who were your teachers? Because they want to know what the rabbinical chain is. Are you from Hillel? Are you from Shemael? Who's your teacher? So we can know what school you're following. And just like in the Jewish tradition, you have certain acceptable parameters. Outside of that, you have things that are considered heterodoxic or outside. I mean, I don't know if the Jewish tradition would use that word, because they tend to be more of a praxis than a doctrines, but they certainly would have heteropraxic normative standards within their tradition. But Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated by a rabbinical student. That would not happen in Catholicism, because you could not have somebody. That could happen in Protestant tradition. So you could have evangelicals that decide to kill an abortion doctor because they actually believe that this is a mass murder and I'm ridding the world of some evil. And that certainly happens here. And like John Brown, the law of God is above the laws of man.
So he murders slave owners.
Exactly. And Nat Turner, who was a profoundly religious African-American slave, who was a preacher. He was trained in an evangelical tradition. So that aspect within the Islamic tradition is very problematic. Now, the only people that have a type of magisterium right now are the Turks and the Iranians, the Shia tradition. So the Turks have a very a standardized tradition, so that all of their scholars go to the same schools and learn the same books. The Iranians have the same situation. The Sunnis, it's anarchy right now. And this is a great problem for us, because there's so many, normative tradition has really broken down. And so I represent, in essence, you know, to help people that are from other faiths, I represent a more Catholic tradition. And a lot of people say, oh, Islam needs a reformation. My response is, this is the reformation. You guys don't know your history. Because the Reformation was one of the bloodiest periods in European history. In fact, there's an argument, I think it's a fallacious one, that the secular state emerged as an arbiter between the great Catholic-Protestant conflicts. But Kavanaugh, I think, really destroys that argument in his book, The Myth of Religious Violence. So this is where we stand. Now, I'll just to finish. My argument, and this is something that I end up being attacked from traditionalists as well, because I do consider myself a traditionalist or a neo-traditionalist, whatever you want to call me. ossified tradition is not tradition. When tradition becomes sterile, which is what happened, as you know, in the Catholic tradition, which created the Protestant Reformation, when tradition becomes sterile, you get Protestant protest responses to that. The traditionalists in the Sunni world have not come to terms with the real critiques that these fundamentalists have made about ossified tradition. And so they're not taking ownership that they have a responsibility to why these Protestant responses to tradition have emerged. And that, for me, is something that irks me, the fact that they have not taken it. We haven't had a Council of Trent. And that's what I would argue, that the Sunni scholastic tradition really needs to have a real reformation, a counter-reformation. And I would argue, and I like this distinction that I got from a Catholic writer, that tradition is the living faith of the dead, but traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And I think what we have today is the dead faith of the living.
Well, if you'll excuse me for saying, you know, as an outsider, what it looks like to me is what people like you and Sheikh Abdullah bin Baya represent is not a kind of Protestantism, if by Protestantism we mean a kind of Luther and Calvin type rebellion. What it looks like to me you guys represent within the Islamic world, or at least within the Sunni tradition, is something on the order of Erasmus and More.
Right.
I think that's a humanist good analogy. It's a religious humanist critique of an ossified traditionalism. In a certain way, it's the radicals against whom you have spoken and who have threatened your life who represent, not to slander Luther and Calvin with this, but who represent a kind of a true protest, not a renewal movement, but a kind of crash.
Calvin was great, too. Yeah. I mean, Calvin was a great theologian.
Yeah, no question about it.
You know, one of our greatest scholars, Imam al-Qarafi, he was an Egyptian, 9th century. Imam al-Qarafi said that al-jumud al-nusus, that stagnation with the texts, with the revealed texts, is always error and leading astray. It leads the individual astray, and it causes him to lead others astray. So there has to be an active, dynamic tradition. And Sheikh Abdullah represents to me an active, living tradition. I'll give you one example. In the recent Marrakesh Declaration that Sheikh Abdullah did in Morocco.
On the rights of non-Muslims Muslim cultures.
Traditionally, Muslims have viewed that there's two possibilities for non-Muslims living in Muslim lands. One is if they don't submit to the sovereignty of the Muslim state, then they're killed, right? I mean, they're fought.
Yeah. Or if they do, it's dhimmitude.
And if they do, it's dhimmitude, right? These are the two, this is the binary that most scholars adhered to for centuries. Sheikh Abdullah actually made, I think, a very compelling argument from tradition. And Donner's book on Muhammad and the Believers, Fred Donner, who's one of the, he's, I think, Yale trained, or Princeton maybe. I think
that would be
Fred
better.
Donner, I think, might have kind of out of Princeton. But he wrote a book called Muhammad and the Believers, arguing very much, even though there's some real problems with that book, but he argued very much what Sheikh Abdullah is arguing, that the original vision of the Prophet ﷺ was an egalitarian society that enfranchised the Jews and the other faiths in the community. And this is proven by the historical document, which is called the Constitution of Medina. And so Sheikh Abdullah argued that this Constitution of Medina has never been abrogated, and that the verse in chapter 9 of Dhimmitude did not abrogate this verse, this constitution. And he says that this is the most appropriate way of living in the modern world with other communities. And so he was reviving something that had literally been dormant in our tradition for 1,400 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very sorry to have to bring this conversation to a close, but I do want to thank all of you for coming out this evening. I want to say God bless you. And I want to say a special, special word of thanks, as always, to my great friend, our great friend here at Princeton, Sheikh Hamza, for blessing us with his presence here this evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
To echo Professor George's comments, we're very thankful for the conversation. It was very enlightening and illuminating. I am sorry about the audio technical difficulties. If you go to the James Madison program website or the Muslim Life program website, within a week, we will have a recording which will have a very clear audio. So I hope that you will go and catch the parts that you may have missed early on. I know that a lot of the Muslims here are concerned about their evening Maghrib prayers. When you leave the chapel, there is a field right across from us, and we have laid out tarps, and you can pray over there. And just start praying when you get there, organize yourselves, and people can pray in shifts. Thank you also very much, and thank you for being here. Take care and have a good evening.